Founded in 1925 by business leaders, entertainment figures, and politicians, the Los Angeles Breakfast Club is a weekly gathering place for those seeking camaraderie and those who love the history and culture of Los Angeles. A tribute to the days of yesteryear when the LABC was a fixture on the radio. On the air will be a monthly review and preview of happenings at the Democracy of Ham and Eggs, hosted by podcast veteran Phil Leonis, co-host and co-producer of Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, weekly US cultural correspondent to the UK's Midweek Drive program on Siren FM.
Hey everybody, this is your friend in podcasting, Phil Leonis, and if what I hear is true, that was a clip from the UK radio program The Midweek Drive for Siren FM and Southside Broadcasting, on which I appear almost every week as a U.S. cultural correspondent. That clip was one in which they were kind enough to promote my brand new podcast, The Los Angeles Breakfast Club On The Air. I hope you'll take some time to check it out. The show's a great deal of fun. The Los Angeles Breakfast Club is now in its 92nd year, and you can join in on the fun wherever you are within the sound of my voice. Check out the first episode on all of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour pages, chillpackhollywood.com, Blog Talk Radio, and even iTunes and Stitcher. What could be more fun? I'll tell you what was fun was going to a press screening this week of John Wick 2. Longtime listeners know what a champion I was in even the weeks leading up to the release of John Wick. And so I was very cautiously optimistic about this John Wick Chapter 2. I saw it, as I mentioned earlier this week, thanks to a good friend of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, Chad Osuna, the editor of Fanboy Nation and co-host of the Popcorn Podcast. Here's a discussion we had immediately following that screening.
Yeah. Man, I think I need a breather after that, honestly.
I was ready to go right into John Wick Chapter 3.
I think you could do that, but you know, I was
feeling like near the end of it, okay, I'm ready for it to be done. I need a break now.
Yeah.
And then the way that this one ended, I was all set for the third chapter.
Yeah, I'm funny you say the kind of the fatigue. That was something that was running through my mind, was how well they did the pacing to keep you from feeling that, you know, too much of that fatigue.
Yeah, but the fatigue, you know, is not a case of the film going on too long or anything like that. But it is. It's just after a certain amount of tension.
Yeah, right. Well, I thought they did a really good job. I mean, the fight scenes are so intimate and brutal. But they, you know, they would last their good, you know, 5 minutes or whatever it was. And they had real good ways of giving you a nice palate cleanser. Which, so that you really didn't suffer from that fight fatigue, that action movie fatigue that you possibly could.
You made a really, interesting point about how it's clear that this film did have a bigger budget than the first one. Not a remarkably bigger budget. We're not talking about this being one of those cases where, you know, a franchise goes from $50 million to $200 million budget. But it certainly has a sizable increase in budget. But they put that money, for the most part, towards expanding the world that you're seeing.
Location, location, location. That was one of the biggest things I noticed.
And also dressing it, right? I mean, you not only do you go to Rome, for example, but you get the clothes you expect in Rome.
In 800
right?
feet, the, turn right onto South Fairfax Avenue.
The clothing budget is bigger. The set design and production design budget is bigger. Yeah. The location budget is bigger. And a couple of notable supporting turns by, I'm betting, fairly pricey actors, especially one previous friend of Keanu Reeves in the yeah. movies. But you were also pointing out how the, you know, with the increased budget, not only does it go towards the locations, but if anything, not only did they resist the impulse that so many filmmakers would have to make it bigger, louder, faster.
Yeah.
If anything, they went in the opposite direction with the action, where the action is far more personal. It's far more one-on-one. It's tighter. It's tenser. It's more condensed.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, they obviously did shy away from making it this huge, we're going to blow up city blocks, you know, that you right. usually get with the sequelitis with a lot of action movies. And everything is very intimate. It's still very hand-to-hand combat based and brutal, and just completely brutal and a lot of fun. I mean,
I'm not the first person to say that the reviews have been outstanding for yep. this, even better than the first one, though I don't, I'm always amused when a sequel has better reviews than the first one, because I feel like there's a percentage of those reviews are people who realize they missed the boat on the first one, and therefore they're basically giving a great review to the second one as a mea culpa for the first one.
Yeah.
So even though you'll see, oh, this one gets better reviews, markedly better reviews than the first one, look, the first one's great, and some people just missed the boat on that.
Yeah.
But I'm not the first critic to point out how this action franchise, 25, 28, 30 years later, feels like in this country, on these shores, we're getting what Hong Kong gave the world in the late 80s and early 90s. It's that exciting an expression of action cinema. And of course, Keanu Reeves was always a huge fan of Hong Kong filmmaking. But I'm not the first person to say that it reminded them of this. But what I was amused by, because there have been other attempts to capture throughout the years Hong Kong action films,
yeah.
even by Hong Kong stars and directors coming to these shores and not recapturing the same magic. And for me, part of it was
turn right onto Melrose Avenue.
That they never had the innate fun. Somehow that element, amidst all the balletic violence, the innate sense of fun yeah. was missing. And I don't know if you caught this, but in the opening title credit sequence, or even before the opening title, there's a little teaser sequence, and the very opening of that, there are images of a classic Buster Keaton comedy being projected onto the top of a New York skyline building. And then right below it, a car action sequence that parallels that Buster Keaton movie is taking okay. place on the streets of New York. And then we're in the action. And what I thought was a great tip of the cap about that was that Jackie Chan and Jet Li and so many of these other great, you know, golden age of Hong Kong action stars used to say that their influence was not American action movies. Their influence were the great silent comedies. And so I loved that John Wick is tipping their cap to a silent comedy, because those films had great stunts and were very exciting and had all this action, but they were always so funny. And somehow the John Wick movies, they maintain that balance of really being fun even when they're being tense. And because we were laughing. I mean, we yeah. were laughing while it was happening.
Also gasping. I mean, yes. everybody was, I mean, some of them were just so unexpected or just, you know what, I say brutal because the action's brutal. But I think that was one of the things that I respected about it was the camera didn't linger. It wasn't, it could have become torture porn kind of thing, but the action is a tad shaky cam, but very quick, so that it's not lingering on, oh, he just blew this guy's head off. I mean, it happens, and it's, but you didn't get lost in the brutality where you became desensitized.
No, nor did you, although there's a shaky cam and there is the sense of feeling like you're there in the action, at the same time, it really, they know how to shoot action so that you can actually follow what's going on. You can see the threats as they're developing, and you can get the real feeling that the actual person you're watching is the one carrying out these action sequences, right? Which is so different than, for example, a lot of American superhero movies in particular, where, you know, not only are we not seeing a human because they're covered by a mask, so you know it's a stunt person, but then even with that, the cutting denies us ever getting to see the real, for lack of a better word, grace and motion that's involved in these action sequences.
Turn left onto Kawanga Boulevard.
I would agree with that. Other than, I mean, I would say similarity to fight scenes. If you're going to compare it to any superhero movie, you get down to the Captain America Winter Soldier movie.
Well, sure.
They have very similar.
But see, you're already comparing John Wick of its type to the very top of the superhero movie. And I would say that would be the point.
And now, your Chilpak Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpak Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpak Hollywood Hour.
And once again, before the opening, that was me talking with Chad Osuna from Fanboy Nation and the Popcorn Podcast about John Wick Chapter 2. And Dean Haglund, I got to tell you, you would have loved this John Wick Chapter 2 movie.
Oh, would I? Because I did like the John Wick Chapter 1.
And even more so, again, as I mentioned with Chad beforehand, there's a wonderful opening moment during the credit sequence where you see a classic Buster Keaton film being projected onto the side of one of the New York high-rises, and then they whip pan down below to see a car chase that mirrors that sequence from a Buster Keaton movie. And so it's,
love that.
You know, it's showing its not only its Hong Kong origins, but its silent film origins. And I wanted to talk about with you just briefly that in these John Wick movies, much could be made of how Keanu Reeves, with his stoicism and almost dialogue-free performance in these movies, is kind of a modern-day Clint Eastwood from the Man with No Name era. And indeed, you know, John Wick 1 kind of feels like a Fistful of Dollars, and John Wick Chapter 2 feels like For a Few Dollars More, and so I'm all eager for Chapter 3, which I hope will be there, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But, of course, it's also another tip of the cap to the silent era and to Buster Keaton by giving the John Wick character so very little to say. It's an almost silent performance.
Wow. Think of that, that we go back to silent movies as the model for great filmmaking.
Well,
and why not?
Yeah, exactly. Why not? I mean, Chad and I were talking about this, how, you know, there's been 25 years where people have been attempting to capture the magic of Hong Kong action cinema in on these shores, not the least of which transplanted Hong Kong filmmakers trying to recapture that magic here. And as I argued, I think one of the reasons that it so often failed was that you were trying to ape Hong Kong cinema, and we were ignoring their influences, which were actually the great silent clowns.
Right. Isn't that fascinating? So you got to go one step beyond.
Yeah. You've got to embrace the inspiration of your inspiration. So this John Wick Chapter 2 is doing more than twice as much in its opening weekend as the first one did. And it's a weekend where three big sequels were released here, Valentine's weekend. You have the 50 Shades Lamer. Is that what it's called? 50 Shades Lamer? I don't know.
Might as well be.
And it's opening huge. Though I love this. Like, people championing, it only opened 43% less than the first one did. Like, that's somehow something to be excited about. And
right.
And
not
even,
70.
And even Lego Movie 2, Lego Batman, opening at less than the first one did, but somehow enough of a percentage of the first one where, you know, everybody's really excited about it. And look, these did open wide. I mean, just absent context of their predecessors, they did a lot of business. But John Wick doing more than twice as much as the first one really lets you know, I think, not just how many people found that first movie on home video and on cable and ancillary, you know, after the theatrical release, but also there's something to when an audience feels like they discovered a movie as opposed to feeling like that movie was shoved down their throats.
Right.
They turn out in really great numbers for a sequel then.
Right. I mean, this is sort of the clever marketing behind what technically was a dog called the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And one marketing guy at Fox stuck it in one theater near the New York University on 14th Street at midnight, and thus became the cult phenomena.
Well, so, but the difference being that the sequel, though, then did not take off, even though people realized they were responsible for discovering it. I would make the maybe the comparison to Austin Powers. The first movie did fine in theaters, but it wasn't a huge hit. It never was number one at the box office. It ended up with $40 to $50 million at the domestic box office. But audiences discovered that film, and they discovered it on home video, especially, and it became such a cult hit. And then cable, so that by the time the sequel opens, it makes $200 million domestically. So it's really the cult nature that marketed the film rather than an advertising campaign. And it happens infrequently, but it's really refreshing when it does. What is interesting to me, though, is looking at these numbers from John Wick 2, which opens as counter-programming on a Valentine's Day weekend, following in the footsteps of last year's counter-programming, which was Deadpool, and which followed in the footsteps of the year before's action counter-programming, The Kingsman. You've got three comedic, really heavy-duty, R-rated, hardcore action comedies released as counter-programming on Valentine's Day. Although I don't know if we can really say they're counter-programming anymore, because if there's no romantic comedies...
Right, exactly. What's everybody going to see?
I mean, you got the S&M sex thing with the 50 Shades of Lamer, and I don't know, maybe Lego Batman has a love interest. I don't know. but the idea of the Valentine's Date movie was always either a weepy romantic film where one of the beautiful young lovers dies, or a romantic comedy. And so neither of those genres opened this weekend. And honestly, if you don't release a romantic comedy on Valentine's Day, it's because you aren't making any romantic comedies.
Right. And this is sort of the thing they swore back in 2001 when the only romantic comedy was Big Fat Greek Wedding that went on to do $300 million right after 9/11. They said, we will never be caught short again without having a romantic comedy somewhere in the gun barrel ready to go. And yet here we are, Valentine's Day, after another traumatic American incident, and there's no rom-com ready to go.
We're going to skip celebrity deaths this week. We'll get to them next week. We've got other things we want to discuss other than a quick tip of the cap to jazz legend Al Jarreau, who died at 76 earlier today. We will champion him, we will celebrate him, and no doubt others on next week's show. Instead, what I'd like to do is revisit one of the live events of last week, because there were two aspects of it when I was busy describing it as Nerd Prom. There were two aspects I did not discuss that warrant serious discussion.
Okay.
The Chilpac Hollywood live event of the week.
I'm, of course, talking about the Annie Awards, the 44th annual celebration of the best in animation. And there were two or three honorary awards were given, but one of them was given to a documentary, Life Animated. And I don't know if I've spoken of this film yet on the show, but this is a documentary based on the great journalist Ron Suskind's book about his own son, Owen Suskind, who at a very young age stopped speaking and then was diagnosed with a serious autism out of which he was never, ever supposed to emerge. And years go by and suddenly they start realizing that he is speaking through Disney films. He's memorized every Disney film and he is interpreting the world through what he's learned. And so he's using metaphor to explain what he's feeling and what he's witnessing. And once his parents begin to learn how to crack this code, they realize there's this rich inner life of thought and sensitivity within this boy. And it's an amazing story.
And it's lucky that it's that Disney works very hard to give all their characters intense and emotional complexity that allows one to have a plethora of emotional context to deal with, you know, as opposed to if he really got into He-Man, what possibly could he express?
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. And one of the things that they explore in this film is how it's going to be something different for each of these children with autism. And yet they are all seemingly engaged in this own process of interpreting the world through whatever uniquely makes them feel safe and secure. Remember the movie Rain Man about how, you know, this autistic savant? What it really, in retrospect, is math made that person feel safe. So they interpreted everything around them by breaking it down into numbers. But numbers were the metaphor to express what they were feeling and seeing.
So,
you know?
Right. So theoretically, then, if we expand on that idea, there is a key to every autistic person.
And that's what Ron Suskind's book is about, and that's what the documentary is about. So a very nice documentary, but anyway, a wonderful that it would be honored at the Animation Awards, and at the same time, when the director introduces Owen Suskind, the subject of the film, the young man, he's now, you know, fully grown, and there is all of four of us giving this beautiful young man, this inspiring young man, there's all of four of us giving him a standing ovation. So, so a doff of my cap to the animation, to ASAFA, the Animation Academy, for honoring this movie, and a wag of my finger to all the constituents who have not seen Life Animated. Shame on you. This is a film that talks about how important what they do for a living is. You would think they would see that the same way the rest of us celebrate La La Land because it champions us. Okay. The other thing, the other honorary award to an just seemingly an amazing artist and an equally fascinating woman was an honorary award given to Canadian animator Caroline Leaf. Do you know this woman's work?
I know it, some of it very well, yes.
I mean, she is as outside the mainstream and as dedicated to staying outside the mainstream as one possibly can be. In fact, in her acceptance speech, she talks about how odd it was literally to be in the belly of the beast, speaking of the mainstream world. But she said the importance of people like herself and those people who are dedicated to working outside the main are that they're the ones that come up with innovations that move the mainstream way of doing things.
That's true, right? There's a lot...
Yeah,
a lot of animation techniques that, you know, stop motion, early stuff that you saw that then became commonplace later on. I'm trying to think.
I love her animation work. All her stuff is hand-drawn, hand-painted, hand-crafted under the camera. All of it.
Right.
You know, is in camera. Anyway, it's fantastic stuff. Maybe you could look up Caroline Leaf's work and speak to it on next week's show.
Yes, because I know I've seen it, and the National Film Board of Canada has a very strong animation tradition going back all the way to the 1940s with a couple of revolutionary guys whose names escape me. I'm so embarrassed. But they also had a very good training facility to train young animators, particularly outside the norm. And then the Canada Arts Council would continually fund National Film Board's animation work that would be shown on not just the CBC. We would watch it at school. They would show all these National Film Board animation things during assembly. So it really was well done in getting that culture out there.
Yeah, she spoke quite fondly and with great gratitude towards the film board, of which you speak. I think her work can be found at carolineleaf.com. People should check it out. All her painting and her animation is there, carolineleaf.com. Dean, check it out and weigh back in on it next week, because I think this tradition of which you speak, of this state-funded, you know, artistic expression, really is important.
Absolutely. At a time when the National Endowments of the Arts seems on a precarious ledge.
Well, yeah, I love that one of those bombers that Donald Trump wants to discontinue, one of them costs 10 times more than the entire National Endowment of the Arts and Humanities budgets combined.
I know. Don't even get me started.
Right. You'd think more arts and more humanity, we might need fewer bombers. But anyway, I'm a dreamer. I'm just a commie dreamer. Anyway.
Commie dreamer, you.
As we say in the White House, dos vidanya. Okay. We have an email that we've been waiting to get to from a loyal listener. Question to Dean and Phil.
Hey, that's us.
As an actor, what do you expect? Oh. I like that combined we make up one actor. As an actor, what do you expect from a director on set? And that's from our friend Melanie Berthello.
Right. So, well, let's see. You know, you hear the story that there's actors, directors, and then you hear the story that, you know, some actors really prefer a director who's very technical, who stays away from the process, and allows just the actor to do their thing, almost a la, not quite Alfred Hitchcock, who said all actors are cattle, but the you know, I think of Kim Manners, for instance, who's like, you know, really allowed you to get into a creative process, but didn't get involved in it, didn't think that he needed to send you to, you know, drama class 101. In order to get you to emotional places that you need to get to. So what do I look for? I look for, what don't I look for? Directors who give you line readings, directors who do general notes, bigger, more, don't do it like that, you know, that kind of thing, not helpful. Screaming, yelling, you know, there's that famous picture of from Chinatown, where the director's standing behind the camera shooting off a 45 as a way to say action, to get everybody super tense in the scene, like you needed to do that. So those are some of the things I don't look for.
Let me start by saying, for directors, the most important thing you can do to get a good performance is to cast the right person in the first place.
Well, that's a good point.
If you do not cast the right person, even if they're talented, even if the material is good, even if you are very good at working with actors, the best you are ever going to accomplish with someone who is wrong for the role is that they might almost become right for it. And counter to that, even if the direction is bad, if an actor is right for it, the worst that director can bring out of them is to make them almost not right for it. But they're still right for it.
So, right, exactly.
So a lot of the pressure should be off. I would say 90% of directing an actor is getting the right person in the first place. So what, from an actor's standpoint, your first responsibility is to have faith that they cast you correctly. And I think that that's so important for actors to go in with, is to go, yeah, I've got this. I've got this. They cast me because I'm right for this. So therefore, I should trust my own innate way of experiencing and expressing this character. That doesn't mean that I don't need maybe notes or new things to think about or what have you, but I don't need to be looking for things that are going to make them happy, make the director happy. That's not about it. That's not what it's about. I'm cast because I'm right for it, so they now are here to help me bring them what they need. And so if an actor can come in with that kind of confidence, that kind of relaxation, because as you were addressing, you know, sometimes you have to play actors who are very tense, or they're stressed out. You have to play these characters. They're very tense. They're very stressed. Well, you can't play those while tense or stressed, right? That's the alchemy we've spoken of before. If you play a character who's boring, you can't make boring choices. If you're playing a character who's depressed, you yourself can't be depressed. That's the alchemy of it, right?
Right.
And so a good place to start is to have confidence that that you are well cast. And if you weren't well cast, honestly, nothing you can do can change that. So don't even worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
The other thing I talk about in my class a lot is about making actors director-proof. I think there's an adage that there's some good direction out there, and there's a lot of crappy direction out there. I want actors to begin to realize there's no such thing as good direction or bad direction. There's just direction. That's it, right?
You take it as you hear it, but you still have to do your own process.
You still have to interpret it, and you have to interpret it in terms of a language that you can convey to the character, because it's the character doing it. It's the character saying these lines. It's the character walking through these imaginary worlds, not the actor. The actor is opening themselves up for the character to emerge. So you gave an example in there. You kind of gave a general sort of thing about, you know, what you don't look for and some of these notes. Can you give a bit more of a specific example about, you know, louder, faster, bigger, you know, these kind of things? Is there any kind of specific example you could give? And then I could kind of interpret that quote unquote bad direction in a way that might be useful.
Sure. This would have been a dance movement stage play, and directed. I'm going to spare you names of who these bad directors are. Canadian, so you'll never see them. Anyway, the task of my character was to run up. Say a line sort of out of context, but from my own internal emotional work, I have to blurt out this line and then run back to my left. And he goes, okay, run straight but left, but then do it bigger, but not comedically bigger.
Oh, my God. So that's tough. I mean, that's almost like just saying bigger and faster. Look, we whether we are actors who need direction, enjoy direction, enjoy discussing process and character with a director, or whether we're one who want to make that process more internal and don't need it, and as you said, prefer more of a technical director. We all would love a director to be able to communicate, and being able to communicate in a vernacular that uses the language and the phrasing and the way of thinking about things that an actor intrinsically does is always going to be helpful. But
right.
my thrust in a lot of my class is, in order to make an actor director-proof, is how can you translate it to serve you when it seems to be anything other than helpful? And something like that, like you just described, bigger, faster, yeah. Reaction to that kind of direction might be for the actor to say, oh, I'm going too slow. Oh, I'm going too slow.
Right.
Right? So I better not go slow. I better not go slow. I better not go slow. But what happens when an actor is focusing on that? Don't go slow. Don't go slow. Don't be soft. Don't be too big. Whatever you're focusing on not being, you're going to manifest more of that.
Right, exactly.
And that's not what the aim was behind it. And I guarantee you, even when they say something as stupid as bigger and faster, they don't mean it necessarily big and fast. They just don't know how to put into words what they do mean. So if you translate it to by asking, okay, why is it that my character might need to really speed through what they have to say? Why might they feel the need to speed through it? Well, now you're asking a question that opens you up to answers that you can play. Oh, maybe I feel the need to speed through it because I'm scared of what the other person's reaction is going to be.
Right.
Maybe I feel the need to speed through it because the meter's running. I know my car is parked outside and I don't have enough time and I don't want to get a ticket and I don't want to get towed. There's so many answers to why you might need to speed through something, but now you've made the scene be about this reality that speaks to something other than what is expressly going on in the scene, and you've given your character life because you've given them other concerns. You've given them human needs and concerns and foibles and insecurities. So ask yourself, if somebody says, I want you to do it bigger, I want you to do it bigger, then you might say, well, now why might my character be big at that time? Why might they? Oh, well, we tend to make ourselves bigger when we're feeling powerless. So what is my character feeling powerless about? So see, there is always a way that you can take quote unquote bad direction, I believe, and you can use it to inspire deeper connection to your own character. And once you do that, what you're doing is going to always be more interesting. And it might often be much closer to what a director wants to see. But let's face it, these are one of those jobs. Directing is tough. And sometimes directors feel they have to say something even when they don't know exactly what to say. So
absolutely.
So that's one of the big focuses I make. I would say this, that for directors out there, at the very least, you can always do this. You can always remind actors where they are in the script, where they are in the arc of what is happening to their characters. Because remember, most movies and TV shows, right, they're shot out of sequence. So I think...
Right, and you can get real lost.
You can get lost. You can. And I think it's especially... Think about this. You just played a scene that was harrowing. And now we've got to go back to earlier in the script. I don't think there's many actors that would mind a director just reminding them, hey, remember, this is before any of this has gone on. We think that everything's great in our life. You know, just giving them little placeholders of where we're at in the script with what we're about to shoot. Also, how about literally where we're at? What is this location? What experience do they have in this location? Remember, this is the
first... You're all alone. You've never been here before.
You've never been. Or this is your first time back at your childhood home in 20 years. You know, these are just little reminders that don't deny the actor's process. They just make sure that they're starting off on the right foot in that process. And directors can and ought to be able to do is when you think it might be important, and actors will often say, boy, I wish I knew that that's how that was going to be shot, convey to the actors what is being seen.
Yes.
Right? Because we as human beings behave differently when we know we're being watched. And
right.
Our characters are no different. So is what I'm doing being seen by one of the other characters? Or is it only being seen by the audience?
Right.
Right? Who's watching me? Because that might change my behavior. And also, in terms of where the camera is, you know, as I've talked about with you, I've gotten to this point through the years, but it took me quite a while before I realized, you know, when we move the camera, when we go out wide, it's because we want to show something. And when we move in to a greater intimacy with a character, it's because we want to share something with that right. character. Well, I think an actor often might appreciate that kind of information. Is this something where you as an actor have an opportunity to show something? Or is this a unique opportunity to share something? And
yeah.
that's an opportunity that's unique to the camera, that's different from acting on stage.
Yeah, I took a acting for a camera workshop one time, and the differentiation, it's the exact thing you're saying, but for the actor, it's like when you're on stage, you're trying to take your inner life outwards, but when you have that kind of intimate relationship with the camera, invite the camera inwards, you know, bring the camera in so that you have this device, this tool that becomes a much more intimate relationship so that you can show, and I use that in air quotes, show your internal life going on, your character's internal life.
Yeah, and it's fascinating when you really get into it because in a wide shot or a medium shot, you as an actor have the opportunity, like you do on stage, to show how that character physically walks through the world, experiences mm-hmm. the world, what they have locked inside them physically, where they hold their energy, where they hold their pain, how they're affected by these things physically. But when you're in a close-up, you get to show that inner mental process. And what's
Absolutely.
Fascinating is, for real human beings, how often the mental process and the physical process are at odds with each other.
So true. Then that's Sergio Leone's whole thing, right? Every tough guy has such fear in his eyes on every gunfight.
And that's why we eschew the medium shot altogether. We go from the long yeah. to the close-up, which is something we do in The Lady Killers. that's true. That's another
that's
reason
true.
I think
that's
I the Leone influence, which was conscious on my part, helped inform my approach to the material. So
love it.
I hope that helped answer Melanie's question. And now I would like us to spend a few minutes discussing the Oscar nominations. They came out a couple weeks ago, a few weeks ago, and we haven't really had the chance. It's not really that I want to talk about snubs and things that were overlooked, but I'll just breeze through a couple of these categories before hitting you with a thesis that I've been asked to share in countless interviews now, oddly enough. So I feel like I ought to be talking about it on our own show. you know, in Best Picture, you got some great films like Arrival and Hell or High Water and some mm-hmm. beloved pictures like Hidden Figures. You know, yes, La La Land's going to win, and that's embarrassing. You've got Hacksaw Ridge nominated, which is just ugh. You've got Lion nominated, which is equally as horrifying. Two-thirds of a pretty good film with a great lead performance by a child actor, completely undone by one of the worst performances in screen history by Dev Patel. Actor in a leading role. You know, it's seeming like it's a Denzel Washington versus Casey Affleck battle, Fences and Manchester by the Sea, respectively. Andrew Garfield gets nominated for Hacksaw Ridge. I mean, he's not as bad as he is in Martin Scorsese's Silence, but he's still so bad. It's unbelievable. Ryan Gosling's nominated, which he should be, but for the wrong film. I mean, how about a Nice Guys nomination instead of a La La Land nomination?
Yeah.
I mean, I understand he's singing and dancing in this one. Well, he's dancing since he can't sing. And then you've got...
Oh, that's all dubbed?
No, it's his... Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That would be great if they had dubbed him with someone who couldn't sing. No, it's his own bad voice not being able to sing. And then you've got Viggo Mortensen, a marvelous actor for Captain Fantastic. I talked about this film when it came out. This film wants so much to be truthful and messy and emotionally complex. And it's so clean and scrubbed and sanitized. And yes, the Viggo Mortensen performance is everything the filmmaker thought that he wanted in this movie, but was unable to bring to any other aspect of the movie. So it's not that Viggo isn't giving a good performance, but I am sick to death of singling out a performance as the only good thing in a movie. It's the only nomination it got. And honestly, if the performance... If the movie's not good, I'm sorry, the performance isn't that great either.
Right.
Everybody failed. Everybody failed. Yeah. You can't say in a bad movie, what a great performance. You really can't. You can say, you know, it's in sports. There's a reason that even if you have the best statistics, you can't win Most Valuable Player Award if you're on a losing team because you're not valuable. It's a losing team.
Right. Exactly.
And
that's totally logic.
And there are so many great performances that go overshadowed because they're not showy. They're not histrionic. All they do is serve to really make you believe the world you're watching. So you're not even aware that you're watching acting. As opposed to a movie like Captain Fantastic, where it's so fake throughout it that you're constantly aware of the artificiality. And while being aware of the artificiality, you're saying, oh, my God, that guy's artificiality is great.
Well, you know, this is the Jerry Seinfeld thing. You get an award for reading somebody else's lines and pretending like it came out of your mouth. So... There's a lot of layers of fakeness to it.
I'm glad that in the supporting actor role, the Mahershala Ali was nominated, Jeff Bridges nominated, the wonderful young man in Manchester by the Sea, Lucas Hedges, Michael Shannon, who's as good as they get, nominated for Nocturnal Animals. I've already addressed Dev Patel. The child actor made that movie. Dev Patel unmakes that movie. Dreadful. Did I mention one of the worst performances I have ever seen by someone in his position? And yet he's nominated.
Go figure.
And I'm also pissed off about, you know, Mel Gibson getting nominated for Best Director. Apocalypto is the one actually good film he made. I know people love Braveheart. God bless them. They love the thing with the Christ. But the one really actually good movie he made from a filmmaking standpoint was Apocalypto. And we don't need to reward that guy, especially in a year when, you know, Hell or High Water gets Best Picture nomination. No David Mackenzie. Hidden Figures gets nominated. No Theodore Melfi. And then what brings us to my real point, no women nominated, you know. I expect better from the director's branch. I mean, this is the branch that awarded Kurosawa a nomination instead of Steven Spielberg 1 year, who gave David Lynch a nomination when Blue Velvet wasn't nominated for any other category, gave Scorsese a nomination for Last Temptation of Christ when the film earned no other nominations. This is traditionally a brave branch within the Academy that will reward those people breaking grounds. I wish they felt that way towards women. There is a woman who should be nominated for Best Director. It's Marin Ade for the 162-minute German comedy Tony Erdmann, which is nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, and which is getting an American remake that's bringing Jack Nicholson out of retirement for the first time in more than a decade.
Lord.
Yeah.
I thought that guy couldn't memorize his lines anymore.
Yeah, he had. Although, if you see this movie, that might work. So it might add an interesting element to it.
Fantastic.
But I want to say this, because we're not seeing Oscars so white this year because of all the diversity. But I would hazard or caution people to make too much of the diversity in this year's awards. And if it, in fact, weren't for the acting categories, there would be darn little ethnic diversity. And there'd be no women to speak of. There's 10 nominees for screenplay, you know, films nominated, 10 films nominated for screenplay. So multiple nominees, because many of them had multiple writers. And one of the women, one of the writers nominated is a woman. One.
Out of 10.
Well, out of more than 10. From the 10 films. You know, no directors, no cinematographers, no editors. The only reason we have really women nominated is because we split up acting into best male and female categories. Which, why do we do that? Why? I mean, I think you've asked that before. Why do we do that? We don't say best male cinematography and female cinematography. We don't separate categories between best male director and best female director. So again, you know, the only reason clearly that we must separate actors is because back when the Academy Awards started, and they knew that this was a smart idea to help market movies, they needed to make sure they had twice as many stars present.
You remember that the all award shows are simply marketing shows. Nobody really cares what is the best and who is the bestest and whatever. All they need to do is get the name out and tell people, oh, we've agreed that this is the best. You should see the best that we have to offer. And then you run out and supposed to see that thing.
Yeah. And so there really isn't any diversity. If there are no women nominated in any categories other than the women only categories, then there is no diversity. So we shouldn't be celebrating how great the job the Academy is doing this year. And I've been caught on these shows in recent weeks where when I will bring up, or someone else will bring up, the importance of female-driven films, then inevitably there is a voice that says, well, don't we mean character-driven films? We just want good characters. The focus, the emphasis shouldn't be on good female characters. It should be on good, real characters, period. And one, that's true. And two, inevitably the person who says that is a man. Just like whenever the topic of Black Lives Matter comes up and someone wants to say, well, you know, all lives matter. Well, that is true. That is axiomatic. That's true. And I notice you're a white person saying that, right? Because it's never been in doubt that a white life matters. It's been historically in doubt whether the lives of people of color and indigenous lives matter. That's the point, right? So yes, we want to get to the point where all characters' lives matter as storytellers. The problem is this, that as illustrated by the Academy, as we know from the halls of power within Hollywood, this is a male-dominated industry. And when we say male-dominated, we mean white male-dominated. And and you know what? They are never on their own going to be saying, oh, you know, what we really ought to do is have more female directors. What we ought to do is have more female writers. When we say female-driven films, it shouldn't just be female-driven in terms of the character on screen, but the people writing them and telling the story behind the camera. It needs to be female driven. And until you get to the point where all men and all women in the position of greenlighting projects are greenlighting projects by women in equal numbers to men, until they are greenlighting projects from people of you know, a variety of backgrounds, ethnic, age, you know, gender, genre, until all of the great, beautiful mosaic of humanity is reflected in the stories being made and sold by Hollywood, then we do need to stress, make female-driven films.
Right. Because
you're not going to find the change on its own. That's the reason. And an audience, again, plays an important role in this. You know, where you put your money and your time, that's what will definitely grow in Hollywood. So if you want to see female-driven films, meaning good female characters, then I would urge you to seek out movies written and directed by women and support them.
Exactly. It's so easy. Just use your pocketbook to determine marketing.
Yeah. So there were a handful of films I wanted to discuss, including M. Night Shyamalan's long-awaited sequel to Unbreakable, which is doing big box office. I'm referring to Split. And and I wanted to talk about, the science fiction film from the end of last year, Passengers. But we only have a few minutes here, Dean Haglund. So I thought maybe we ought to talk about what we're reading instead. What do you think?
Oh, sure. Let's do that. Wow.
So
that
was
a good musical thing.
So what are you reading, Dean Haglund?
Well, you know, in the pursuit of art history, I'm up on the biographies of both Velázquez, the famous Spanish royal painter of the 16th century, and contrasting that to Peter Paul Rubens, one of the great Belgian painters of all royalty, Spanish, English. He traveled the world. And, you know, for those who think an artist has to suffer and starve and be tortured to produce great work, look no further than Rubens, who had a happy personal life, married a couple times only because he outlived his wives, his children all successful and joyous. He had a working studio. He'd get up every day at 4 a.m. and paint till 5 p.m. and then spend the evening with the wife and family in a rather luxurious villa in Antwerp. So, you know, it's a very good antithesis if you've just read Lust for Life, the story of Vincent van Gogh. I recommend the biography of Peter Paul Rubens.
That sounds very cool.
Yeah,
that's
and inspiring.
Yeah, and I like that people would read them as you know, back to back.
Yeah, right. Because you go, oh, that great art came from Van Gogh's, you know, intense passion and madness. But then you go, well, wait a sec. Here's Rubens, who just as impassionate and intense, but organized, is a good business sense. And training as a plethora of soon-to-be famous artists in their own right, including Van Dyck and a few others that went through his studio system. It's like, oh, that's quite a delightful sorbet to a otherwise dark salad.
Dark Salad. Oh, my goodness. That should be the name of our podcast, Dark Salad. and before we get to the end of the podcast, I will talk about what I'm reading. But I can't let this go by without asking you. We've probably talked about this before, but did you ever read The Agony and the Ecstasy?
Yes, of course. Irving Stone went out of his way to do a lot of amazing bio novels back in the day. And Agony and the Ecstasy is about Michelangelo and the painting of the Sistine Chapel.
And the Sistine Chapel. And I really... Yeah. I read it 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago now, probably 32 years ago, and it still stays with me, that book.
Yeah, absolutely. And how Leo the X fought, and how they were not passionate, but almost antagonistic embrace the two of them had in seemingly creating the ceiling together.
Right, absolutely. You know, yeah. Yeah, fascinating stuff. I finally finished reading Cliff Nesteroff's The Comedians. the history of stand-up comedy. And, you know, I learned some valuable stuff. And the best news of all is I don't have to watch the CNN series, The History of Comedy, because now I know it.
Oh, I was going to watch the CNN.
Well, you can. Series. You haven't read the book, so you might as well.
Yeah, you're right.
And I'm two-thirds through Dispatches from Pluto by Richard Grant, these snapshot postcards of the Mississippi Delta and life on the Delta. And I'm almost finished with Mark Frost's novel, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, whetting my appetite for the return of Twin Peaks to television, although fascinating how there are some key contradictions between the novel and what happened on the first Twin Peaks show. And you think, oh, well, these are continuity errors, but he's addressed them in interviews and said, well, we'll see if there's continuity errors. And so there's many hints that perhaps parallel realities are going to be in play in the return to Twin Peaks.
Oh, so, my gosh.
So very exciting stuff. And I love this whole section of the book that is about L. Ron Hubbard and Parsons, who founded Jet Propulsion Lab, and all the crazy Aleister Crowley sex magic rituals that went on with them and their friends in Pasadena. Back in the late 1940s. So it's bringing so much history to bear in this book, which is ostensibly about this little town, Twin Peaks.
Now you've made it so that I have to fulfill my lost bet and watch that entire series. I'm excited. Not excited. Now I'm borderline curious to do it as opposed to dreading it. So congratulations. Kudos to you.
Well, man,
to raise me.
If you do that, if you watch them, then you could give a little report about each episode each week leading up to and maybe even during the sequel series dropping on Showtime. That's the end of another exciting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We'll be back next week to talk about movies and so much more. You can
Fantastic.
You can find every episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review.
Like us on Facebook. We're facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Yep. And follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil, which is the exact same handle we are on Instagram.
That's great.
Spell out the word and.
Write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Melanie Berthello did, and we'll be happy to answer your questions. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Belated spoiler alert.